This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. All change in the Carabao Cup. Manchester City's reign is over. Out for the first time in 5 years, the David Moyes train keeps on trucking or training. We were all wrong about him. So the competition is up for grabs now. Nice to see those Carabao specialists getting a run out and delivering your Minaminos, your Nketias, your Kepa Arrizabalagas. And we'll take a deep dive into scorpion kicks because of Divock Origi. Elsewhere, Koeman sacked. Sid was desperate to come on again so soon. Also, we'll pay tribute to Walter Smith. And how uplifting to see the reaction to a top-flight footballer coming out, and how soul-destroying to see David Beckham take 150 million quid off Qatar. All that plus Herb footballers, Barry meets the public, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Hello, John Bruin.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hey, Max.
So let's start with the Carabao Cup then. It's been a good competition. I feel like we should never have criticised it in the past. And West Ham knocking Manchester City out on penalties feels, Baz, sort of important for the tournament.
Yeah, well, Manchester City have had this incredible run of dominance in the tournament. Pep obviously takes it very seriously because they've been champions for the last 5 years. But he also feels understrength teams insofar as Pep is able to field an understrength team. He gives youngsters a run out and they're all depressingly good. But it will be nice to have a new name on the trophy. And if that name turns out to be Sunderland, all the better. West Ham have done them a big favour by knocking out City.
We'll get on to Sunderland in a bit. West Ham, John, are mightily impressive, aren't they, at the moment?
They are. And much of the credit goes to David Moyes. His revival, when did it took? It took like from about 2014 to about 2020, you would say, was at the point that we started thinking of David Moyes as a good manager again. I was thinking about this. There can't be many managers that have had that longer lag to suddenly reassert themselves. Now, all the jokes were flying around last night that, you know, maybe if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is pushed aside, there's this guy at West Ham that could maybe step in and do a job. let's set that aside. But what he's got there is, and what David Moyes has proved himself best at, is he's got a fan base on his side, 60,000 at the London Stadium to watch a League Cup game. He's got a team that's very resilient, and we're lacking Antonio. And I watched the penalty shootout last night on the TV, and I was delighted to see that they switched to Peter Drury, my favourite commentator. The bombast in which he described Manchester City's 5 years in a day unbeaten in that competition. Now, a friend of mine said to me, which I thought was quite amusing, said, you know, he hadn't realised until that point that he was living in this golden era of Carabao Cup dominance. But I do think, actually, if you think about it, Liverpool won it four times in the 1980s, and that reflected just how dominant a team they were. Manchester United had a spell in the 2000s when they won it a lot. I think the League Cup does point to how good a team actually is, if they can just pick it up by not really trying that hard and then deciding to win it at the end. But that's all over now. Thank you, West Ham. Thank you, David Moyes.
I think Peter Drury would describe, you know, just letting the cat out with bombast,
yes,
wouldn't he? You know, there's sort of one, I mean, I like it, but there is one Peter Drury setting. Johnny Liu wrote a brilliant piece, Lars. I'm going to read a paragraph. It's quite a long one, but it's good, about how we all viewed Moyes and how Johnny Liu said he himself was sort of completely wrong, saying it's sort of, perhaps it's time to recalibrate like the whole discourse around how we rate managers and why, and junking many of the preconceived ideas we have about why managers succeed or fail. And he says central to this is the tyranny of the X, Y and Z feature. You're probably familiar with the format. Eating meals together, daytime naps and murder ball. How Marcelo Bielsa transformed Leeds. Bikram yoga, Flaubert and reruns of Columbo. Inside Scott Parker's Bournemouth Revolution. Googling himself at 4 a.m. Weeping dressing room laments on the savagery of man. Playing Matt Ritchie at fullback, where it all went wrong for Steve Bruce at Newcastle. This stuff is everywhere. And in its reduction of coaching to simple, catchy tropes, it encourages us to see the manager in the same way we view a household cleaning product, a mix of miracle compounds that either works or it doesn't. We are probably as guilty as anyone, I guess, on here of just sort of deciding who's good and who isn't for some random reasons that we've seen from somewhere else.
Yeah, though I am, of course, mildly offended that you bring that to me, yeah. Because I've said about a bazillion times on the pod...
If you look at the numbers,
That I believe quite strongly that it's a mistake to look at managers as either good or bad. I think managers, like all people, are better in certain settings than in other. I think managers have different qualities that work in different contexts and doesn't... Like, David Moyes at Real Sociedad... wasn't very good. David Moyes at Sunderland didn't end well. Probably Sunderland were doomed on a myriad of different levels at the time, and it was probably not his fault and all of this. But I think on the scale of being wrong, and I'm not going to pretend I thought David Moyes at West Ham was going to be as good as it has been. I think if you'll go back, I did say that I think he's perfectly fine. And if you give him a decent team of Premier League players, he will stabilise them and make them hard to beat and make them decent. And he's done that and then quite a bit more, of course. But I think you're not wrong about the sort of trying to reduce managers to simple tropes. That I'm sure, but that's... I don't know. I think those pieces are interesting still. I mean, it's nice to have little nuggets of what they do and whether it works or not. But maybe, I guess, reducing that to the reason they've succeeded or the reason they've failed is too simplistic, yeah.
It's a journalistic device. It's also a sub-editor device, which is just, you know, who writes the headlines, is to split that up. So if you're a manager, if you are looking at a club as a journalist, you try and find that little detail. And it is always some random stuff, like, you know, someone eats banana bread on a Tuesday, or, you know, listens to the music of Traffic or what have you. And that is the detail that you've got, because one of the keys of journalism is that you put in a bit that the reader doesn't know. And that's what that is. And yeah, so it's a headline device, and it's used in quite a few popular newspapers and websites, let's put it that way. But yeah, I do agree it's reduced to a sort of trio of things. And David Moyes, you know, hard work. Essentially, his thing is like hard work, hard work, and hard work. That doesn't really work, does it? As a selling point,
get the basics right.
You know, Moyes didn't go well for him at Manchester United. With the benefit of hindsight, it probably went better than we thought at the time, considering how other managers have fared since. Didn't go well from at Sunderland or Real Sociedad, and I think he had possibly had a bit of an existential crisis, but he had time out of the game. He regrouped, he travelled around picking the brains of other coaches, studying their methods, and sort of relaunched himself as West Ham manager. I definitely thought he was a beaten docket, but he has proved me wrong in that regard. But he certainly didn't cover himself in glory in the two jobs he had before West Ham.
Crazy breakfasts, enormous dog, and a hatred of Burnley. How Lars Sivertsen made it on Football Weekly. Beard rustling, music snobbery, and you know, a nostalgic harking back to Macclesfield Town. How John Bruin made it to Football Weekly. Booze, fags, and fags. How Barry Glenn... I'm sorry, Barry. I'm sorry. Oh, look, well done, West Ham. They did tremendously well. And it's opened up, hasn't it? I mean, I don't know which other game sort of caught your eye. I mean, Divo Origi's goal, and he only sort of pops out, doesn't he, for the Carabao Cup, like Minamino does as well.
He is a deeply strange footballer, Origi, isn't he?
Yeah.
Because he is someone who is capable of doing brilliant things, but he can also look totally inept. And he doesn't come across as lazy on the pitch. I mean, he does run around quite a bit, but he is apparently slightly relaxed in his attitude behind the scenes. But he was also one of those players who did exactly that thing that we just talked about, or he was the subject of an article that did exactly that thing. And there's a really good interview a couple of years back that Andy Hunter of the Big Paper did, where one of the things Origi talks about is that he likes reading books. And if I wasn't a footballer, I'd be a psychologist, he says, and maybe I'd be a psychologist. And he likes to watch some TED Talks and stuff like that. And because he said that, the whole framing becomes, you know, Origi, this unusually smart footballer who speaks many languages and reads books about psychology and watches TED Talks, and that he's this sort of... And we do this a lot with players. If there's one little detail, like John Bruin says, that we're like, ooh, maybe I didn't know that, then we hang an entire thing on it. But yeah, very, very good goal. Very quirky finish and a mysterious man.
Xander says, now that we've muddied the waters around half volleys, can the panel define a scorpion kick? Obviously Giroud at Arsenal is the template, but is it still a scorpion kick if you're not off the ground? Like Origi's in the cup this week, is Origi's a lobster or a crab?
It was a sort of crap
instead?
Scorpion kick though, wasn't it? It was quite ungainly. Yeah. If you can have an ungainly scorpion, I don't know if I don't know if they do deportment in the scorpion world.
Aren't they all a bit ungainly? They sort of scurry about. I've never seen them as very graceful.
But it was just sort of, it was a piece of improvisation, let's call it that. But it didn't necessarily, you know, I mean, I think of the classic scorpion kick, which is René Higuita, you know, the inventor.
I've talked about this. I was there and I'm sure I've done this on the pod already, but he did it about 100 times in the warm-up. So by the time did it, it was like, I didn't care. And the offside flag was up. So the Higuita myth, as I believe, is wildly overstated, but technically was very good, I grant you.
Well, I went to an award ceremony a few years ago and René Higuita was receiving an award for services to football. Guess what he did when he arrived on the stage?
A scorpion kick?
It was, yes.
Excellent. What did he? And did he pull it off? Did someone throw the ball to him?
Well, he was not quite as graceful as he once was. Let's put it that way.
I was about to say, he must be in decent nick for that to
be
possible.
In reasonable nick, but yeah, there was a bit of a creak there. He might have been sore the next day.
Elsewhere, Chelsea got past Southampton on penalties. Kepa, the hero. Leicester got past Brighton on penalties. Nice to see Dewsbury Hall playing, the only wedding venue currently playing in the Premier League. Brendan says, much like Baz and Ramos, I hadn't realised that Ryan Bertrand had moved from Southampton to Leicester. Given that Vestergaard's also moved in the summer, does that mean Leicester are employing the Liverpool model of signing all of Southampton's players to create a Premier League winning team? Lars?
I had a Barry moment on this one. I've got to hold my hands up. I had really completely forgotten that the Saul Niguez to Chelsea thing had happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
So when he was there, I was like, oh, hang on, yes. Listen, that was the thing.
How did he play? Because his debut was terrible. Like, he had a really bad game. And that could be for so many reasons, right? You know, you just arrived, new country, new league, et cetera, et cetera. But there were a lot of people saying, look, that just shows you the Premier League is just too fast for some players. How did he do in this game?
I don't think he was particularly impressive. I've only seen highlights and read the report. But it's really weird that his shocking debut for Chelsea, he's really cast him into the wilderness because he's so far down the pecking order for that position now in central midfield. It's hard maybe to see a way back for him just on the back of one horrendously bad performance in his first game, but he's clearly a good player. But it's just funny how it can work out like that.
I suppose it's a tricky position to get into because you've got obviously the Jorginho Kante axis, and then Kovacic is underrated, I think, in general. And then I think Tuchel really wants to give Loftus-Cheek every possibility of making it. So when you've got Saul on loan sort of kicking around, it's not, you know, not your... Maybe... It's going to be hard for him to get the minutes, I suppose.
Spurs are through. They won 1-0 at Burnley. Brentford tweeted, for the first time in 111 years of trying, we've done it on a cold night in Stoke. They won 2-1 there. And Arsenal beat Leeds 2-0. Nice to see Bert Leno again. Nice to see Nketiah and Callum Chambers. And Nketiah's goal was fun, wasn't it? Brilliant first touch. Second touch, brilliant. And then sort of like a shinned it. And then you could see he was like, oh, shit, I don't know if this is going in. And it did. It was really nice. I don't know if you saw this. A really nice tweet from a bloke called Dave saying, last night I took my son to Arsenal for his first match. He was buzzing all day for it. I wasn't sure if he'd ever go as he has autism. Once we were in the ground, he struggled with about 50,000 people shouting, was having a hard time. Halfway through the first half, I could see he wasn't going to get used to it, so we were going to leave. When we left the stadium, a steward asked why we were leaving, and I told her. She asked me to hold on, contacted someone else. Next thing I know, we're being walked towards club level. They've got a sensory room there where we could watch the rest of the match. The bloke running the room, Luke Howard, was fantastic with everyone in there, and between him and the stewards that helped turn the night into a great memory. Thank you. So well done to Arsenal Football Club for doing a good thing. And finally, QPR 0, Sunderland 0. Sunderland win 3-1 on penalties. Barry, you were there.
I was there. I had a very pleasant evening at the football. I hadn't been for a while. The one thing I would say is, you know, how people always say you get a much better view of the match at the match than you do on television. When you're sitting at the very front row, or second from front row behind one of the goals, you really don't get a good view of the match at all. So, I mean, there's this offside decision where QPR had a... Charlie Austin had a goal disallowed for offside, rather controversially, I believe. I didn't see it. I have no idea. I just saw the flag go up, and that was enough for me. I've since seen stills which suggest it was an absolute travesty.
Terrible decision. Absolutely.
I don't care. and then when the penalty shootout was on, I was really hoping it would be into the goal I was sitting directly behind, but it wasn't. It was at the other end. And I couldn't see any of the penalties because the two teams were standing along the halfway line blocking the view. So in terms of watching a game of football, I saw very little, but it was a very enjoyable night, and I was pleasantly surprised by how decent Sunderland looked, actually. Both teams fielded under strength sides, so it's difficult to know how much to read into it, but they play a good style of football.
Jim says, has Barry ever been happier than when he met my mate Mike at the Sunderland game on Tuesday night? It honestly warms the cockles to see him so cheerful. And Mike got in touch to say, I had the pleasure of seeing Sunderland beat QPR on penalties on Tuesday night, my first chance to see them play since COVID, but by far the highlight of the night was bumping into Barry in the queue to get in. It was exactly as I'd imagined. He had a fag in hand and was late for kickoff as he'd been in the pub. I'm sure he won't be happy with me sharing that he was absolutely lovely and happy to pose with me for a picture. I live in Clapham, so the next time that you and Wilson meet on a bench on the common, let me know and I'll bring the wine. And there's a little picture of you with a big Cheshire Cat grin, Barry.
I'm a man of the people, Max. What can I say?
Oh, lovely. Would you like to meet more? We could announce somewhere you're going to be on the pod, and then people could just meet you in the street somewhere.
I've got a good idea where he'll be, but I won't reveal it on here.
I'm generally not hard to find.
No.
It's true. All right, well, look, that'll do. The draw is on Saturday, I think, for the quarterfinals. So we may talk about that for 1 minute on Monday's pod, and that'll do for part one. Part two, we will begin by paying tribute to Walter Smith. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's pay tribute to the former Rangers manager, Walter Smith, who's died at the age of 73. He won 21 domestic honours in two spells at Ibrox and got to the 2008 UEFA Cup final. Also managed Everton and Scotland and was Sir Alex Ferguson's assistant at Manchester United. Fergie led the tributes, saying, I'm absolutely devastated. Walter was a special person. He was a great friend of mine for years and years. In all that time, you were dealing with a man of great moral compass in how he lived his life and the friendship he offered so many people. His contribution to football with Dundee United, Rangers, Scotland, Everton and Man United was immense. Let's bring in the Guardian's Scottish football correspondent, Ewan Murray. Hey, Ewan.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you. And the impression you get from Walter Smith, and when we talk about people who've passed away, almost the most important part, for me at least, is, were they a good person? And it comes across in all the stories that he was a really good person.
Yeah, that's the key point. I mean, we'll go on to speak about his football achievements and football qualities, but when people say what a good guy Walter Smith was, they aren't exaggerating. That was his key thing. He was a decent man. He had perspective. He was extremely humble. He was respectful to people who he dealt with. And then what is quite often a kind of unhinged environment around the Old Firm. He didn't get involved in that really at all. I'm not saying he never get excited or emotional about what was going on, but he put football rivalries in the proper context, and he got that. He was a Rangers fan. I mean, he was immersed in Rangers. He grew up supporting Rangers. But I remember having dinner with him years ago, and he spoke about when he was young, as far as he was concerned, you went to the football, you wore your scarf on a Saturday, supported your team. But that's kind of all it had to be. You didn't have to shout about it all week. You didn't have to throw your allegiances into other people's faces for the rest of the week. And I always thought that was pretty good advice that would, you know, a few people would, I think we all get carried away with football and football rivalries. But I always thought that was an example of Walter's sense of perspective. I sometimes laugh and maybe it's unfair, but people in football can die and sometimes their reputation is overstated. But that's not the case here. He was genuinely extremely well liked and extremely well respected, largely and mainly because he was such a good guy.
And phenomenally successful as well. And yeah. I wonder if, you know, south of the border, we don't respect a manager for great achievements at Rangers because we sort of look and go, oh, it's Rangers and Celtic. One of them will win 9 in a row.
Yeah, although it hasn't happened nearly as often, obviously, as people would think. Once each, basically. I think, actually, Walter's second tenure at Rangers was more impressive than his first. I think when he took over, although there would have been difficulties, he took over from Graeme Souness. He had to get Rangers over the line for the title with, I think, 6 games to go, which they just about did. So that could have gone the other way in theory. But if you take it at that point, Rangers had a lot of the best players in Britain. There was the English club's ban on European competition at the time. So, you know, they had the likes of Chris Woods, Terry Butcher, Trevor Stephen, Gary Stevens. They all played for Rangers. Increasingly, they had spending power that could match the best teams in Europe. And to be fair, they got criticism around that time in his first tenure because their European performances weren't seen as strong enough. So there's a football debate around that. But the second tenure, when Celtic were stable, Rangers, you know, he went on and still won multiple honours. And that, I looked back again the other day, I mean, that team, without being disrespectful, that team that he took to a European final in 2008, and I covered that run, you know, strongly remember the quarterfinal, the semi-final in Florence. For that team to get to a European final, bluntly, was a hell of an achievement and a sign of what a good tactician and what a good manager he was. By the time they got there, they'd kind of run out of steam, and Zenit St. Petersburg beat them pretty comfortably. But that was an example of how he was, you know, he remained. I mean, here's one way of putting it. He was involved with Jim McLean at Dundee United in the early 80s when they had fantastic success. And what they did was incredible and won't be matched on that scale, certainly in Scotland. To be successful when involved then, and by 2011 to still be winning the championship in Scotland, in 2008 taking a team to UEFA Cup final, well, that shows an element of managerial versatility and talent that, you know, I think has to be recognised.
John, you crossed paths with him.
Yes. Well, funnily enough, when I was a young lad, some family friends of ours used to live around the corner from Walter Smith. So I've actually skateboarded from the top of Walter's drive down the hill with his son. So, yeah, but beyond that, I was at the 2008 UEFA Cup final that you were in talks of in Manchester. And, yeah, that team that he put together, who was the striker you in? Jean-Claude Darcheville, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, he scored a wonderful goal in Lisbon in the... in the quarterfinal. Sorry, that wasn't a wonderful goal. Stephen Whittaker scored a wonderful goal, but Darcheville scored. Anyway, yeah, I mean, players of that ilk.
Yeah, yeah, who'd been a Forest reject and, you know, and I think that Walter was pretty good at getting a tune out of players that maybe other managers couldn't. And the other memory I would have shared is, I think up in 2010, I went up to Glasgow, went to a Rangers-Man United game, and if I'm correct, I think maybe things weren't going quite so well for Rangers at the time. And who should step in to defend him in the post-match press conference in a Glaswegian accent, which I couldn't pick apart at all, but Sir Alex, who pretty much spent the 20 minutes or so just sounding off about how Walter was the best, and his respect for the man was clear. And I think, you know, that he led the tributes was very fitting. And of course, Walter came down to England at one last time, didn't he, with Sir Alex when...
2004 FA Cup final he was involved in, actually.
Yeah, I think it was when Steve McLaren moved on, and it was at a point when Ferguson said that he felt alone and he needed someone to come and help him out. And who better than Walter Smith, you know, a football man that I think he considered his equal, you'd have to say.
I was listening to Richard Gough talking about him, who said, like, he, you know, Richard Gough said, for me, he was a second father. Ali McCoy's too. On TalkSport did an amazing tribute and said the same thing. But I think Richard Gough was saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Walter Smith was a sort of trained electrician.
That's right.
And fitted Richard Gough's cooker when he signed him as well.
Well,
which is a lovely story.
I spoke to Richard the other day because their connection goes right back to Walter picking up Richard in his first night on trial at Dundee United in 1980. But that's true. Walter was an electrician from the East End of Glasgow who supported Rangers now. He had a decent playing career, largely at Dundee United. He would describe it as modest. But, I mean, he played football. But, yeah, he had that trade. He had, I don't want to patronise people, but he was well-grounded. He was a working-class guy. And I don't want to over-egg the point. The other thing that has struck me this week is that Walter would be intensely... I mean, the scale of the tributes has been incredible. Walter would be intensely embarrassed by this scale of... tributes. He would be very uncomfortable with it. It was mentioned to him once that Rangers should consider putting a statue of him outside the ground, and he didn't like this at all. He didn't like this notion. He said, well, you know, if we lose this game on Saturday, they'll want the statue knocked down. You know, that was his kind of attitude. So it's not been lost on me that the praise towards him, while entirely merited, would have him kind of shuffling uncomfortably wary here.
Yeah, among the among the many tributes, Ali McCoy gave a very emotional one. He was presenting the breakfast show on TalkSport when the news broke, and he stayed on after the show had ended to talk about Walter, and he clearly was very close to him. But he revealed the nugget that Walter was a massive Bon Jovi fan. that Ali and somebody else had brought him along to see AC/DC at Hampden Park, I think it was, and he had a real good time there, so they converted him to being an AC/DC fan. I was not expecting to hear that, I must say.
He was a huge Crosby, Stills and Nash fan as well. I know his favourite Bon Jovi track, Blood on Blood, an album track from New Jersey. Blood on Blood.
Right. Wow.
I can still...
That's a deep cut.
I can still remember when I was just a kid, Friends Were Friends Forever, and What You Said Was What You Did. There you are.
Wow.
That was his favourite track.
Perfect way to end it. Ewan, thanks for coming on, mate. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Speak soon.
Ewan Murray there, our Scottish football correspondent. Paying tribute to Walter Smith. Of course, we extend our best wishes to his friends and his family. Let's talk about Ronald Koeman, who has been sacked. We can go live to Sid Lowe, who is... Are you in a taxi, Sid? Where are you?
I'm in a taxi, yeah.
Okay. You sound excited to be there. Are you off to Barcelona? Where are you off to?
No, I'm in Granada. I'm nowhere near Barcelona. Yeah, you can't control these people, Max. It's a Spanish club. One day a Spanish club will sack someone at a reasonable time of day and not at kind of quarter past midnight on a Wednesday night.
So it's not a surprise, is it? Or is the timing a surprise?
Yeah, the timing's a little bit of a surprise. See, I mean, I think you even asked me this on Monday's pod, didn't you, after the Clásico, whether this changed anything. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the answer was, well, no, not really, because we knew this. And we knew that he was fundamentally in a job because of the difficulty of finding an alternative and making that happen. The one thing that, of course, could accelerate that, although that process can only be accelerated if you can complete it, is if they reach the point of patience completely running out. But in truth, it had already gone. The question was whether it felt like something you absolutely have to do now. They were beaten 1-0 by Rayo last night. It wasn't a great performance, although Koeman yet again claimed that the only thing that was missing was the chances. And actually, I think that doesn't do him any favours, that his post-match press conferences are so unconvincing. And so maybe it's a slight surprise the moment that it was decided, but the fact that it's happened isn't a surprise at all, no.
It's great that you're in a taxi with R2-D2. I'm pleased about that. So what happens now? Javi?
These are not the droids you're looking for. well, yes, that's what they want to happen now, Javi. Now, you asked about the timing, and people who are experts on Qatari football know this better than me, but I believe it is it 3 days since he won the Qatari Cup? So his work here is done, I suppose, and maybe that means he now can come to Barcelona. So I wonder if perhaps this was something that was always going to happen. Although the early assumption, and it is early, and who knows if things might even have changed by the time people are listening to this podcast, the early assumption is that even if Xavi is confirmed today, which we wouldn't be at all surprised if he is, it might well be that he doesn't actually take over, or doesn't actually sit on the bench for a couple of games.
He'll obviously be given buckets of time because he's Xavi, but he's got quite a job on, hasn't he? Or whoever gets this has things to do.
Yes, they do. Lots of things to do. And to be honest with you, I mean, I would argue that Koeman's been given quite a lot of time, considering. And in particular, Koeman's been given time considering, of course, that he had a new president come in halfway through his time in charge. And the new president tends to want his own men, of course, and this president did, and he didn't want he didn't want Koeman. And he even told Koeman in the summer, listen, give me 2 weeks to try and find an alternative. And if I can't, you can carry on. Which is never the basis of a stable relationship, I think you'll find. Xavi will be given time because there's a belief in him and there's a need for him as well. You have to remember the kind of the political element of this. There are, presidents have a need of certain managers. And Xavi, I think, will be an extremely popular choice. But as you say, there is a lot of work to be done. And of course, right now, there's not a lot you can do in terms of changing the squad you've got, because they could make some signings at Christmas, but not very much. They're in a position where they can't really afford to make this managerial change. The most they have to spend on the entire new technical staff is, I think, 3.9 million euros because of the salary caps and because of it. There's a particular clause that enables you to spend beyond the salary cap on a new manager if you need to. But only, I think, at 10% of your total, or is it 4%? I can't remember. No, 4%, I think it is, of your total budget. And so there isn't the money there to make changes. But then, in a way, I think people look at this and say, well, that's okay. And that buys Xavi time, because everyone knows that. And there will be a belief that he can get more out of this squad. Because I think this is one of the other things that probably needs to be thrown into the mix here, is that there's an awareness that there's a reality, and it's a troubling reality at Barcelona in terms of the players that Koeman's got available. And he keeps on saying that. But the players he's got available probably should still be able to play better than this.
All right, Sid. Well, look, enjoy your... How long's your taxi ride?
I don't know. I reckon probably only another 5 or 10 minutes, but I don't know. I must admit, I'm not entirely sure how far away I am.
You're awfully busy, aren't you, Sid? You should take some... Just, you know, you should tell the bosses you don't want to do as much travelling and things.
Yeah, but the job wouldn't be done particularly well if I didn't travel.
Well, no one will mind. Is there nothing else you need to tell us, is there?
Well, I mean, I feel like I should just say that Barcelona were beaten by Rayo Vallecano last night, and everybody's, you know, going on about Barcelona, of course, because they've sacked Koeman. But Rayo are great. So can I just say that? Rayo are great.
All right. And the top two are Sociedad and Betis, aren't they?
Got Sociedad, Betis, Sevilla and Real Madrid, I believe, although I need to double-check the table, all on the same points. So yesterday, obviously, this is only if you count the league table as being a league table at the time, you know, live, in play. Yesterday, yeah. We started the day, we had Real Sociedad top, Betis top, Sevilla top, and then Real Madrid top. And they could all be taken over tonight by Real Sociedad again. Although that, I don't know. Does it count as taking over if Real Sociedad take over themselves?
I just like the beep, Sid, to be honest. Cheers, mate.
Nice one. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe there, out on his way to Granada. If you're passing, if you're, you know... it's unlikely, given how long this takes to put out. But if he's still in a taxi and you're in Granada, give him a wave. Why not? That'll do for part two. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about Josh Cavallo, the A-League player who came out in an emotional video, plays for Adelaide United. We think he's the only known gay professional male footballer actively playing in the top flight of their league. He said he'd been hiding who he is and living a double life. Has been an incredibly positive reaction, actually, from pretty much everyone in the game. Liz Ward, director of programmes at Stonewall, said coming out as a gay footballer in the public eye takes incredible courage. We're delighted that Josh's loved ones and teammates have been so supportive. All sports need to do more to create an inclusive and welcoming environment for LGBTQ plus people. Lots of people asking us how transformative a moment this might be. I wasn't surprised, Barry, that the reaction was very positive, but it is at least positive that reaction was almost universally very positive.
I would have been surprised if anyone had responded negatively. People who may have negative feelings towards Josh will probably keep their thoughts to themselves, because they'd be vilified if they didn't. But... heartwarming to see how positive, not particularly surprising. Whether or not what he's done will be transformative, I don't know. But what he has done is made it easier for anyone else who might be feeling tormented or struggling about whether or not to come out. And he has shown them that it almost certainly won't be as bad as they think it could be.
Mm. And interesting that he's young, right? He's 21. And quite a lot of players who have come out in the past have been either retired or coming towards the end of their career. So that is another positive sign. Tom says, "Look, I'm tired of this, but the tweet from Newcastle United needs addressing. How can clubs, the league, the governing bodies have any credibility?" I suppose we should add to that the Premier League, since you know they were the ones who allowed the takeover and haven't said anything since. I feel sorry for the Newcastle United social media bod who has to type that knowing what we all know. So Newcastle United tweeted a powerful and inspirational message. Football is for everyone. Newcastle United is right with you, Josh. And understandably, a lot of people, including me, I don't know if any of you did, just tweeted, I tweeted free Sahail, right? This is, you know, the 25-year-old who's apparently in prison in Saudi Arabia for posting a picture without his top on. This just highlights the hypocrisy of and the conflict of the whole situation.
Listen, whoever's running the social media account, whoever's running the comms team, there does seem to be a disconnect with those that we know are the owners of the club, despite what the Premier League and has said or not said. Unfortunately, Newcastle United, in being taken over by Saudi Arabia, will be associated with what goes on in that country. Now, the problem that arises from a social media post like that is obviously the accusation of hypocrisy and also the unleashing of what we call trolls, I suppose. And there were some pretty... a lot of people were saying, you know, hang on, you're the club that has owners that advocate this type of action. Then you get people who are obsessed with homosexuality and write some pretty nasty things. It's added that element, hasn't it, to and that debate, that edge of nastiness. When this happened, I think it was Henry Winter of the Times, and I think Henry's wrote this in good faith, saying, you know, a good comm strategy is needed here, something that a few people leapt on. I don't know what comm strategy Newcastle can have to get themselves out of this. I really don't know. You'd have to be superb at that to even attempt, really, to get out of this situation in which they're going to be criticised and accused of hypocrisy. Unfortunately, that is how we must view Newcastle United now.
And the hope is that if enough people campaign for this guy, yes, who's in prison, and any other one, other people who are in prison just for being gay, are let out of prison. That's like ultimately like that would be the end point for this in a good, positive way. While we're on human rights, David Beckham has reportedly agreed a deal to promote the Qatar World Cup, said to be worth £150 million over the next decade. Amnesty International said, "We'd urge him to learn about the deeply concerning human rights situation in Qatar, be prepared to speak out about it." A spokesperson for Beckham told BBC Sport, "David has been visiting Qatar regularly for over a decade, went on to play for PSG, so he's seen the passion for football in the country and the long-term commitment that's been made to hosting the World Cup and delivering a lasting legacy. He has always talked about the power of football as a force for good on many levels. He's looking forward to what he thinks will be a great tournament." You do wonder, Barry, if he needs £150 million. Perhaps anyone needs £150 million. But it seems a strange decision on that for someone who doesn't need it.
I was pretty disappointed, but I am looking forward to seeing how he goes about earning his money, because it will be a tough gig, I suspect, if he's asked difficult questions. How will he answer them? Will he even pay lip service to everything that's gone on around the preparations for the Qatar World Cup? I don't know. It will be interesting to see. If you were offered 150 million max to be the face of Qatar, would you take it?
I'm so gutted. I'd have to turn it down now, wouldn't I? I've become so pious. I couldn't. Yeah. Could I? Do you know what the real thought would be is, could I deal with a current account that said 150 million pounds, but just the face that Philippe Auclair would give me would cut through. It would just. I'd be dead inside. I wouldn't like you know.
Such a lot of money, Max.
It is a lot of money, isn't it?
Isn't it a case that Well, that's the price that the David Beckham organisation is prepared to accept, that presumably he wouldn't have done it for 2 million, or, and it's just, it ratchets it up and up and up and up until it comes, OK, we'll take the money.
If he gave 130 million to UNICEF, is that actually doing quite a good thing? It's taking money away.
Well, that's like a carbon neutral type of thing, isn't it? Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think, I think that would be a good gesture. But again, we're operating on what's the price of you buying off your conscience,
yeah,
aren't we?
If I got 150 and I gave 100 to charity, do you think Philippe would still talk to me?
No.
Then I can't.
You'd have to give it all to charity.
And then what's the point?
In which, yeah.
I think Beckham is at least showing admirable versatility here, having also been the official an official ambassador for England's 2018 World Cup bid.
Are you saying, Lars, you're not allowed to change international allegiances with bids? Once you've represented one country for a bid, you can't cross over.
Yeah, I suppose it wasn't the Qatar bid that England lost to directly. It was the even if it happened on the same day. So he hasn't completely... I mean, I think being both the face of England's 2018 bid and the World Cup in 2018 would have not been ideal. But since you've gone on to the next one, perhaps it works.
Yeah, I mean, Pelé wrote the rule book on this, doesn't he? He's advocated for everyone's bid, so...
Maybe, I just think Beckham should spend all of next year talking about the mistreatment of migrant labourers in Qatar and just go completely rogue on it and see how that goes.
Good luck.
Speaking of difficult questions, did anybody see Robbie Keane on Good Morning Britain getting a 50-second yes. question from Ranveer Singh, which finished, "What's your view in terms of the global money structure around football versus the political and moral compass that we as a society ought to have?" While Robbie Keane was just standing in front of some kids playing five-a-side.
In Dubai.
But, we do have to... But we should all be asking these questions. But you sort of hope, would you get... Is it fair to just throw that question at someone or... We all have to answer the questions.
You throw us some pretty weird ones sometimes, Max.
That's true.
I thought he dealt with it quite well.
Yeah.
I've heard worse answers to that type of question. Yeah.
The question went on for hours, didn't it? The question went on for hours and hours. Robbie must have been going, oh, God, I don't know where this is going. Anyway, John, you covered England's women in the World Cup qualifying.
I stepped in for Susie, who's on her holidays.
She's having a lovely time in Iceland. I saw a picture of the Blue Lagoon.
Yes, she is. Yeah. And I went to the England Northern Ireland game, which was a case of eventually Northern Ireland getting tied and then Beth Mead scoring a great hat-trick. And then I covered the game. I didn't get to go to Riga. Trick of the trade, covered it off TV. 10-0. And I think that is 32 goals, unanswered goals in four qualifiers for England under Serena Wiegmann. They look really, really good. The problem is that they're playing against inferior opposition. But, of course, it's the draw for the Euros today in Manchester on Thursday. The word from the camp is that they're looking forward to facing stronger opposition because they're not really being tested. And it was interesting... listening to some of the debates between the journalists, which was the same that we have, or I've certainly had in the men's game, is that should the minnows play a tournament below playing the bigger teams in international football? So I think the difference between... I think the story was that there were only 1,800 women play football in Latvia at any level. They're playing amateur teams, essentially. So this idea of there being no easy games in international football is stretched even further as a misnomer in the women's game. But, yeah, I'm very excited for the Euros, actually, having seen that. And England have so many attacking players. It's really exciting to watch.
Yeah, and we're going to cover the Euros next summer. Looking forward to it. I'll be back in the UK, Barry. We can have a pint if you want.
Hurrah!
Don't sound too excited. You're more excited meeting Mike, some random Sunderland fan in the street. You're happy to see him, you know. Anyway, Premier League this weekend. Biggest game is Spurs-Manchester United. Nuno under pressure. Ole under probably even more pressure. Marcus Rashford tweeted, "I can't lie. You haven't heard from me on here because as a United fan, I didn't really know what to say after Sunday. I was embarrassed. I am embarrassed. Our fans are everything. You didn't deserve that. We're working hard to try and fix this. We have to redeem ourselves. Danny Mills on Sky Sports News, in an ad break, said, Manchester United are just shit, but they are. Which was...
It's a very succinct analysis from Mills. I like
even it. Even for Danny, it was quite strong, wasn't it? But it's a huge game. I mean... Having watched Spurs West Ham, and however bad Manchester United are, I just think Manchester United would win this game. I don't know what you think, Lars.
I kind of concur. As much as I am very suspicious of what's going on at Man United, and I don't think the situation is sustainable, Tottenham are not good at the moment. It is proper bad there. I guess the thing about Spurs is that they do have... You say almost the exact same thing about the two teams. Even if the team isn't working, they have individuals who can do stuff. You know, Tanguy and Ndombele can have one of those days. Harry Kane and Son Heung-min are obviously very, very good. But you say that about United too. You know, no matter how bad they are, maybe Bruno will play a brilliant pass to someone and off they go. So it should be a fascinating game between two teams that are currently much less than the sum of their parts.
Exciting weekend of Premier League football coming up, looking at the fixtures, but we'll discuss them all. On Monday.
I think one of the more... there are some good games this weekend. Aston Villa-West Ham is a fascinating one because everyone's talking about when Ollie will go. I think Dean Smith might go before him.
Yes, the fans aren't happy, are they, Barry? That's what I get. No,
they've lost three in a row. Their last two defeats were humiliations. One against Arsenal, which they were absolute garbage. Particularly in the first half, they threw away that game against Leeds or Wolves when they were 2-0 up at home. And so if they lose four in a row, and there's a very good chance they will lose four in a row, there is talk that Smith might not be long for the job. I mean, he's clearly a very nice man. He's Villa through and through, but he's struggling with life after Jack.
He is. I think that would be short-sighted. And I can imagine it's getting...
It seems very soon, yeah.
I agree, but it's a short-sighted business.
I'm looking forward to Norwich-Leeds.
Yeah.
Just because I feel like Norwich needs to do something after last weekend. And Leeds obviously haven't been as good as we were hoping they would be this season, after last season. And they look a bit vulnerable. Maybe having scored two goals... In their first nine games, finally they meet a team you'd think they'd be able to put a few goals past Norwich, but they might also not be able to do that.
That's true. Did you see David Squire's cartoon? I think Daniel Farker was on a tube and lost Josh Sargent just there with the tube carriage doors closed. Martin Ziegler is at some football admin-y thing. I should know what it is, but I don't, where they're making lots of decisions about things. Including five substitutions in football set to become permanent, proposed at the International FA Board panel meeting today. Strongly supported. Will put renewed pressure on the Premier League to follow the rest of football from next season. Also, one proposal effectively given the boot by football's lawmakers panel today was South America's proposal for half-time to be extended from 15 to 25 minutes. Can you imagine that? Absolute disaster that would be. So anyway, do we think five subs is... good and an advance for football?
I think Jurgen Klopp will look upon this as a victory over Chris Wilder. do you remember they had that real row?
Yes.
In which Jurgen couldn't help but drop Chris Wilder's name in there. Now the argument isn't it that is that this favours the bigger teams with the bigger squads? Of course it does. It also essentially changes the game of football, because you can have players just coming off the bench maybe earlier in the game, and you know you can have players that are more suited to playing 30 minutes of football, your Adama Traores or so on. But actually, I heard this on the excellent When Saturday Comes podcast, and I think this is true. It's the death of the utility man, because those of us old enough to remember when there was one sub, the guy that was the sub usually could play in every position. So farewell Alan Harper, farewell Clayton Blackmore, farewell, you name your club's
utility... Paul Warhurst.
Yeah, your club's utility player that would come on and say someone had an injury, play either up front or right back or you know, wherever. So that's the end of that. Sad news. Phil Neville was a utility player later on in his career, of course.
Sam says, what on earth's happening to Bayern Munich today? They lost the biggest defeat for centuries, Lars.
Yeah, that was a wild one. And the craziest thing was, even though if it was in the cup, Bayern had a really strong team out. So it was pretty unexpected. I didn't see the game, unfortunately. By all accounts, Gladbach just really went at them and put them under pressure and worried them. From the highlights, Dayo Upamecano had a bit of a mare, and things were up, but they were kind of counterattacked to death. Bayern, worrying times for Julian Nagelsmann, who saw this from isolation, of course, having been struck down by COVID, and it does seem like. It is in the German Cup the real action is. I mean, they got knocked out by Holstein Kiel last year, Bayern. So if you're looking for a German football competition where Bayern don't win every year, maybe just bin off the Bundesliga and follow the German Cup.
Martin says, I'm one show behind, but to my knowledge, there's been no discussion as yet of FC Roma's 6-1 loss to Bodo Glimt. This needs to be rectified. There was discussion from a Roma point of view, but there wasn't from a Bodo Glimt point of view. Lars, I believe you've talked about Bodo Glimt on this podcast. Normally, it's then edited out, but we should keep it in because you beat Roma 6-1.
Well, I mean, listen, it's good that we have this now, and if not last week, because it would have been an entire pod of me laughing. I wouldn't have been able to contain myself. It was an incredible result, obviously, and I accept that it was also a complete meltdown from Mourinho's second string team, which he seems to thoroughly despise, as he usually does. But it's worth noting that, of course, Bodø Glimt are not just a Norwegian team, but even in a Norwegian context, they're not that wealthy. I mean, their budget and all that is all publicly available. Last season, their entire sort of wage bill for all staff, not just players, was about 4 million euros, just for everyone in the club. I think they've beefed that up to around sort of 4.75 million euros this season. But they're not a big club. And having sensationally won the league last season, then they then lost their entire front three, which is what happens in Norway if you unexpectedly do well. Everyone wants to go abroad. So they kind of had to retool over the winter, and they've done so successfully. They're top of the league now and have just sort of thwacked Roma 6-1 in the Europa League. So it is actually quite extraordinary what they're doing up there. And there are players there who can and will go abroad, I'm sure. But there's also something going on at the club where they're managing to make everything a lot more than the sum of their parts. They've created a very good environment, and they do all kinds of things like encourage the players to meditate, and they have a retired fighter jet pilot doing mental coaching sessions with them and stuff. Like they're a really interesting outfit. All of this is happening again at a club with not a big budget, in a town of, from memory, maybe 55,000 people, something like that, quite far away from everything, inside the Arctic Circle. So they're an absolutely wild story, and they're playing really good football. I mean, watch the highlights if you haven't seen them yet. Some really, really good goals they were scored in that game.
Meditation, Maverick from Top Gun, how Bodo Glimt masterminded victory over Roma.
Alan says, following the bay leaf peacock farrell highlight on last week's pod, what other aromatic leaves, herbs or spices inspired top level footballers past and present can you come up with? Lee Parsley, coriander flow come to mind? Mark says, hot on the heels of your bay leaf conversation on Monday, compiled a six-a-side team of herbaceous footballers plus a manager as follows: Bradfrey Dill, Turmeric Laporte, Danny Rosemary, Baz Silvino, Timo Werner, and Gareth Bayleaf. All right, come on. With Ronald Koeman, coach, no longer.
Yeah, I've got Ronald Koeman, Coriander Herrera, Nicola Pepper, that kind of work. Ben Chilliwell, that kind of works.
Okay, yeah.
I also had Danny Rosemary. Aaron Marger Ramsdale.
Okay, nice.
Aaron Lemongrass, that kind of works. Alan Dill, I think that's good.
Yes.
Tim Elderflowers. Aaron Watercresswell. And Unai Celery, that's borderline. And Jeff Horseradish.
Very good. Jeff Horseradish is the absolute best one, isn't it?
Kevin Sage. And Oregano Gunnar Solskjaer.
Hey.
I had Florence Cinnamon Pongal as well.
Very good.
That's very good. I was thinking about something for cinnamon. I couldn't get there.
Oh, there we are. Nothing beats Jeff Horseradish.
No.
On Barry being a murderer and not knowing who Sergio Ramos is, Marty says, was Barry pretending not to know Ramos was at PSG the start of him working on the insanity defence for his upcoming trials? Dave saying, peak Guardian Football Weekly, where Barry offers to resign over not knowing Ramos went to PSG, but standing firm if a convicted serial killer. Anyway, thanks everybody for getting in touch, and that'll do for today's pod. Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.